Mr. Clark, you've written a great variety of stories. How did these stories ever occur to you?
Well, they didn't occur, actually. They were just experiences of the day or of the last week, or perhaps something recollected out of my long and sometimes hilarious career as a reporter. The point is about these stories that they're everyday experiences. I think perhaps the reason I've made friends with them is that they read the stories and laugh to think that the same thing happened to them, but they didn't make anything of it. They forgot to tell about it. This thing about the lady who lost one of those shoes, heels that they wear on their shoes, little sharp, what do they call those?
Stiletto heels.
And there was a place down in the downtown district where they were putting up a new building, and they put a little sort of a shed over the sidewalks to protect the passersby. And I was walking, and it's crowded at noon, and this young lady ahead of me stepped in a grating and broke off her heel, and with a cry of distress, she fell back, and I caught her, and I was holding her up.
Yeah.
And the lady coming in the other direction, an elderly lady, saw me grabbing this young woman who was in obvious despair, and she struck me over the head with her umbrella, and a couple of men grabbed me, and it took quite a little while for the young lady and me to explain that I was just holding her up because she'd lost her heel in the... Well, you know, normally we'd be so amused and perhaps a little ashamed, you see, of being hit over the head by an umbrella by an irate old lady for being some kind of a molester of the fair sex, and you'd forget it. But no, I make a tale out of it, a story. It's been like that all through my life. This one story that I hear about from the old soldiers a lot is this about the pants button, where I got word, I was tipped off that Churchill was going up to Scapa Flow, and I was in London, and I got a quiet tip from a very confidential source. So I rushed down to the station with my typewriter and my little overnight bag, and here's a whole bunch of my fellow journalists, mostly English and Scottish, gathered together, guarded by a couple of naval officers. And they had been, the news that that the old gentleman was going up to Scapa Flow had somehow leaked. And this was a serious breach of security. Well, I saw them, and I didn't join over. I stayed off by myself to one side. And you know the typical London station, crowded and misty, and the little train going boop, boop, you see. And all of a sudden, one of these Englishmen detects me off to the side, and he says, "There's one." And they come over, and they were just in the act of imprisoning me with the group when some bright naval personage said, "Well, look, they know about it, therefore they're far better aboard the train where we can control them than let them get free." And they grabbed us, and they were in the process of grabbing me when the train's whistle and the gate was supposed to be closed, and they were all rushing through, and I started to rush through when this pants button at the back of my trousers gave way. And I wear braces. I don't know how the English braces are, but I had these braces that the thing at the back slides through, you see, and there I was with my pants coming down in a London station, and I had to stop, and they were so confused at getting these others aboard that they missed me. So I found a porter, and he took me into the gents' room, and we found a nail, and he bent the nail, and he showed me how to make a temporary pants button, you see, on which I could hook my braces. But he says, "You were going to catch that Scottish Express." I said, "Yes." "Well," he says, "there's another one in 15 minutes. Oh, So I got aboard the next one, you see. And I was almost up to Scapa. I was way up in the north of Scotland before some naval gentleman came walking through and detected me. Are you a journalist? I said, yes. Oh, come with us. And he took me. The two trains had been joined together somewhere in the train, and I was herded in, so I never did get to Scapa Flow and see the great Churchill visiting his navy. It's trivial things, trifling things. As a child, I remember I was a shrimp. I was a very small. All of the fellas of my age, when I was 12, they were all big fellas. When I was 14, they were all big fellas. But I had to run with my age group. Therefore, I never played any games. I never played hockey, football. I was a camper, fisherman, a hunter when I became old enough. But to hold my end up with the gang, I was the storyteller. I was the only one of the bunch that did any reading. And when I'd read Sir Walter Scott, you know, I'd tell, fascinate them. When they were sitting down all sweaty and exhausted from whatever games that were going, my share of the companionship of my youth was as a storyteller. So I think I was a storyteller from as early as I can remember. And naturally, when you're a storyteller, it makes you something of a liar.
Yeah. Well, I think at the basis of all really good writing, I know you don't like to be called a literary figure, certainly is the ability to tell a good story and to hold interest and to bring the reader into the action of the story. I can remember one you wrote on a watchmaker. And I never knew, for example, that a watchmaker, to call himself a watchmaker, actually had to make a watch.
He had to make a watch.
Yeah.
Yes, there's very few of them.
Now, it was the things you saw in that incident, in your mind's eye or however, that made the story, things that nobody else would see.
Well, I think...
I think it's the eye.
I think other people see things, but they don't take note of them. Mm-hmm. What I mean is this, that my love of nature, for example, as early as I can remember, I looked at everything, every insect, every bird, every plant. I wanted to know the name of every tree. The world was filled with fellow beings, and I wanted to know who they were and so on. Well, then when I went into the reporting, I just carried on a natural sort of bent that made you constantly aware and alert and conscious of the endless delight of life. And out of that came these.
I think this comes out in your stories, in that you seem to be exactly the opposite kind of man to one you describe in one of your war stories, and I think you described him this way, one of those good, intense characters who go through life missing nearly everything.
Yes.
I have a feeling that you didn't miss very much.
No, I hope I didn't. I hope there was an old saying when I was young and fishing and so on, where they made fun, my fishing companion made fun of how I would put my fishing rod down to chase off to find out what that bird is that's singing. And they said, well, he doesn't want to die not knowing. You know, and it's a darn good description. And there's actually now, with the vast increase in interest in nature, there's an enormous number of people, especially in the New England states. There must be 1 million bird watchers alone. And all the botany walkers, the people who go into the woods to look at and recognize every living creature.
You took time to notice a flower, I'll notice
too.
You
took notice of everything, you see. And this interest in nature is, I think, increasing the number of people who aren't going through life missing nearly everything. They're starting to look.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mr. Clark, when you were in both wars, and you certainly wrote a number of war stories, did you at any time feel that because war was pretty grim, that you tried to bring out a bit of the more pleasant side of life in some of your stories when you reported back from the war.
Well, no, I
some of the little human interest.
Yes, well, in the books, they've picked out the friendly and kindly and redeeming anecdotes. But as a reporter, you see, I was a soldier in the First War. And in the Second, I was too old to fight. I was in my 50s. So they let me go as a war correspondent. And as a war correspondent, I covered it in all its tragic dimensions. I very rarely tried to redeem it.